You rented pay-per-view porn and watched Cartoon Network in the same night.
Geek Juice Radio.
Centipede was my joint.
What was Biafra's first name in that movie? Was the Jello?
All the stoners are giggling at it.
Visit our website at www.geekjuicemedia.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome one and all to another fantastic edition of Geek Juice Radio. We've got a great show for you tonight, with plenty of throat clearing along the way. My name is Charlie McMullen. With us tonight will be Alex Jowski.
Hello, how are you?
We have got Josh Hadley.
I'm barely here.
And we have got the Lord and Purveyor over everything that we do, Mr. Todd Sheets.
Hello!
How are you this evening, Todd?
That's it, just hello?
It's really great to be here.
You said he was a busy man.
I am a busy man. It's really great to be here. How are you guys doing?
Are you guys at all a little intimidated since Todd's your boss?
A bit, I'll be honest.
No need for such things.
Not being able to see me goes a long way towards not being intimidated.
Last week, Alex, you talked to Brad Jones about independent filmmaking. And our boss here, Shad Teets, he is an independent filmmaker with quite a few titles under his belt. A few, and I don't think, Todd, I'm speaking out of turn here, a few that you're not exactly proud of, am I correct?
There's a few that I don't like very much, yeah.
Can you explain why?
Because they're almost like a Josh Hadley radio show. They're no good, but people seem to listen.
See? What better way to put it?
No, honestly, it's because they're movies that I did when I first got started, man, and you know, they're learning experiences, and most people put those in a box, in a closet, way down at the bottom, or maybe even hidden in a garage somewhere. They'll pull them out years later to reminisce with the friends that they made them with, but no one else ever sees them, including, you know, big name people like Spielberg and Lucas. They still do the same thing. So my thing is, you know, I allowed those to get distribution worldwide like some kind of a fool. But when you got someone that you look up to, an idol like Dave DeCoto, come to you and say, hey, I like these, I could put these out. When you're a kid, you go, okay. And then years later, you go, why did I do that? Except for the fact that Dave's awesome. I have no reason other than that why I agreed to such a ridiculous idea.
Alex, don't you have some issues with Dave DeCoto you'd like to work out with Todd?
Well, I'd like to interview the guy sometime. I like Dave DeCoto's movies, his early ones especially, like Sorority House. Not Sorority House.
Sorority Babes and the Slam Ball Bowlerama.
Thank you. Creepazoid, and then some of his Full Moon stuff through Puppet Master 3 and whatnot.
If you'll excuse me, I'm going to do the Charles dance.
His recent stuff, though, I mean, props to him because he's still working with Linnea Quigley and Brink Stevens and all them. But those movies are just odd. I'll leave it at that.
I like to take credit for bringing Linnea and David back together. They hadn't talked to each other in years, and then they decided to come together on a Night Watch episode, and I kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and I think it helped, because then the next thing I know, they're hooked back up, and they're doing movies again. And, you know, Dave is a bit of a genius with marketing.
Oh, he is. And definitely give him that.
And he's really carved out a niche for himself. See, the deal is, in this day and age, with everybody who thinks for Scorsese picking up a camcorder and throwing out some ridiculous found footage epic of eyeball destroying portions, people like Dave have to find a new avenue, because the problem is your buyers, your video store chains, which there are very few of anymore, but like Family Video or Blockbuster, they take a look at these things and they go, okay, all of them have cool looking boxes. On an average, there's so many movies being released per week that the buyers can't possibly sit down and watch all of them. So what he did is he found a market, and he stuck to it, and he built it basically almost just a small group of filmmakers hitting that market. And along with cable TV and the pay-per-view guys, Dave has created a whole new empire for himself. So yeah, to you and me, they're not the same. They're not Sorority Babes, but at the same time, for his audience, they're exactly what they want. And so you got to give the guy credit for that, because in my opinion, I'd rather watch a Dave DeCoto film any day. I'll watch it standing on my head before I want to see another found footage nightmare.
Well, speaking of that, Todd, have you seen the new Evil Dead trailer that came out today?
I refuse to watch it.
It the rage is boiling inside me. I'm sure it'll come out in an upcoming Radiodrome.
Well, there's a reason why I refuse to watch it. I'm not trying to be close-minded, but to me, Evil Dead was one of the last pure horror films we got. There was a few after that, not that many, because it seems like even though we call movies out there now independent movies, yeah, they are, but they're not, because somewhere along the line, they still have an in with the studio. But when Evil Dead was made, it was like a truly independent project. It was a college film. I mean, these guys were working their butts off. They didn't even know if they were going to get this thing finished. It was so difficult for them. They put their mind, body, and spirit through so much torture and turmoil. And Evil Dead was the right movie for a generation. It came out when we needed it. It kicked all of our asses. I remember being in a movie theater, 400 people losing their minds over this movie. No one knew what it was. No one saw anything but like a 30-second little commercial before a movie the week before. No one knew what this thing was. It played a grindhouse. And the next thing you know, it's become a phenomenon. Part two came out. That's the one people started seeing. Even though it was also independent, it still had Dino De Laurentiis behind it. So therefore, that's kind of not independent, even though it is. So it was more of a studio picture. So Evil Dead to me is the last of a breed. And that's why it ties with number one for me with the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because they both have so much in common. But they're both also completely different universes. So I find that movies like that just don't get made anymore. Sure, you know, Eduardo Sanchez and those guys that made Blair Witch are out there making movies, but that's also one of the problems I have is they made Blair Witch, which they admitted they had no idea how to even make a movie. They didn't know what a director's line was or how a movie should be made. They didn't know how to do special effects. They knew how to come up with a great, brilliant marketing plan and hand a couple of cameras to a couple of people that shouldn't have had them, shake the hell out of our eyeballs for a couple hours, and send people packing out of the studio after a guy peed in the corner. But Hollywood, in its wisdom, said, hey, these two guys are brilliant filmmakers. Let's give them both multi-million-dollar contracts and get them working on some new ideas for movies. Well, the problem with that is these guys, even though I have nothing against them and I've liked some of their work after Blair Witch, they weren't really classically trained filmmakers in any sense of the word. Their background wasn't the same as someone like Sam Raimi. And that's indicative of what's going on. A guy who makes Dial commercials or does a Trent Reznor video suddenly gets the film contract, where a guy who's been going to film school for 15 years can't. And it's really frustrating. Now, you know, I just watched Lovely Molly, and that's you know, one of the guys who made Blair Witch there. That's his new movie. And while I enjoyed it, I noticed some things have stayed the same. They believe that style is when you shake the camera like insane. To me, style is style. And if you were to make a student film and shake the camera like a maniac, like you just handed the camera to Epilepsy Joe, the rest of the class would be like, oh my God, that's awful. And the teacher would give you an F instantly for unwatchable garbage. Because it's the fact that when you're in film school and when you're learning how to talk in the language of cinema, which I didn't know when we did these early movies with DeCoto, but I was willing to learn and tried to learn. You know, there is an art and a language of cinema that these guys have thrown away. They don't care about the line of direction or composition. That's the problem he still has to say. He's got great ideas. But even that movie Seventh Moon, which he did, part of the Ghost House Pictures line, Seventh Moon had a great idea. It had creepy as hell, white, weird, ghost-looking guys running around the woods. It had some neat things going on. Not a whole lot of plot, admittedly, but it was still a creepy movie. And they damn near destroyed it by the use of this shaky camera. And in this case, it didn't even make sense because it's not in the hands of, like, a student, or in the hands of a guy like a picnic who suddenly sees, like, in Cloverfield, you know, that made more sense, or in a movie where, like, a news movie or Quarantine, the original Rec 1 and 2, it made sense in this because there's a reason why shaky cam on location are doing a spot for a news program and suddenly all hell breaks loose. Understandable. When you're making a movie like Seventh Moon or like Lovely Mom, which has a set boundary of cinema, you're setting it up like a regular cinematic film, suddenly to have shaky cam, it doesn't fit within the perimeters of the storytelling, I don't think, and therefore I think I'm less forgiving.
Oh, I agree with you. The shaky cam, there's too many movies.
You can't do an accident on purpose.
I agree. And to me, getting back to the original point, Evil Dead was a happy accident. I mean, these guys were in the right place at the right time with their hearts in the right place, pouring every ounce of blood, sweat, and money and tears that they had in their lives, begging their mom and dad and Uncle Joe for a donation to just film stock. These guys loved it so much, they really wanted to make movies. And even though there's guys like that out there right now, I mean, we're among them, it's just not same. The remake, that movie, kind of defeats the purpose, especially when there's so many remakes already being done. How about come up with something original? The thing I loved about the Dawn of the Dead remake is the fact that it was so cool, and it could have been set in a different setting. They didn't even need the damn mall. And my frustration was, why not come up with a new title for it instead of calling it Dawn of the Dead? We know why they did it, because it's a recognizable name when people went to see it. But that movie could have been anything. It didn't have to be a Dawn of the Dead movie. It's this Evil Dead. This could be a completely different film, or it could be a continuation of the Evil Dead saga. It doesn't even have to be, because who's to say another group of people don't stumble on a Darien Deep and it could happen?
No, but this one, Todd, it's about drug intervention. There's no Ash character. It's a bunch of teens that go up to a cabin to help their friend detox cold turkey from heroin. And the whole thing is, get it symbolic. They're exercising demons while he's trying to get clean, like he's exercising his personal demons. Get it, Todd? It's deep because it's symbolism.
God damn.
Yeah, I get it. But I think my biggest problem with all these is the fact that, you know, it's just like the thing, the prequel. Love or hate it. Some people love it.
The pre-make was horrendous.
Why didn't they give it a different title? Because now when you go to the video store, not only can you not find the original thing with Howard Hawks' version, you can't even find Carpenter's brilliant remake. You find the new one. It's same with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's hard to find the original. When you go look for Halloween, you see Rob Zombie's abomination, but you don't see the originals. Once they make a remake, the originals are kind of forgotten. You can't really find them anymore. You can find them right when that remake comes out in the theaters, because they'll suddenly push them out on Blu-ray or DVD saying, hey, look, because they'll market them suddenly. They kick a few more bucks on the old one. But after that, they're gone. And it's really frustrating for me as a lover of film and classic cinema that I can't go and find the originals as easily. And things like remake of The Fog are on Blu-ray, but they never put out the original, ever. And they've been doing that more and more. There's other films like Assault on Precinct 13, keeping with Carpenter. Remakes on Blu-ray, but the original isn't. A, make the movie better, like with Carpenter. He did his remake of The Thing. The only reason he did it, he loved the Hawks version, which led him to read the original book, and so he kind of did his own thing with it. Go back to the source material or do something to either improve upon the original or take us down a different road that the original could have gone down, but maybe didn't.
Now that I've got Todd all fired up, do you guys want to take control of your own show?
Oh, I was really into that, because I agree about the remakes are – there's too damn many of them out there. And the other day on Facebook, like, somebody was talking about The Fog, and they're like, oh, this is the worst movie I've ever seen, and I didn't know they were talking about the remake. I'm like, what are you talking about? The Fog is a great movie. And I went off on this guy, and he's like, I was talking about the remake.
Yeah, I mean, when a movie makes you lose respect for Selma Blair, I mean, where do you go from there?
Well, let me tell you something. The first 5 minutes of the original Fog has more creativity and imagination than pretty much any movie being made today. Why I say that is that first 5 minutes, the kids around the campfire with the watch dangling there, I mean, it sets the mood perfectly. And then you see, like, the town going kind of crazy, phones ringing, lights popping on and off on cars. And it's just an incredible mood setter that is so indicative of Carpenter as a filmmaker. And when I watch that, it's a combination of the cinematography, the sound design, and great acting, and the composition that Carpenter is always such a king at, you know. And I was like, really, to me, is an unsung hero, because everyone talks about lots of different horror movies, but no one really mentions The Fog. And I'm mentioning it because I personally think it's kind of an underdog, and it's a classic.
Yeah, I think with movies that are being made today, mood and tone are afterthoughts now, and I think that's horrible. I think the reason Now, as I say this, I still have not seen Seven Psychopaths, so in retrospect, I might turn out to sound like an asshole here, but I think the reason why the trailer for Seven Psychopaths hit me the right way is because they captured a mood that has not been captured in I don't know how long.
That's because I was in the movie talking like walking.
Talking?
I have a gun. I don't care. I'll shoot you. So?
Deal with it.
I love that.
I love the movies that he's in.
So okay, then I know something that'll set Todd off if you guys just want to hear Todd rant for a while. Todd, I got carded at Walmart for buying Poltergeist, a PG-rated movie.
That's because they thought from your size and stature that you were actually a 9-year-old who had glued on a beard.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm used to being carded for, like, if I'm buying a Resident Evil game or something like that, fine. All of a sudden, when she asked for my ID, I'm like, the movie's PG, right? And she even looks on the box, and then the clerk's like, why is it asking me for your ID? Never been carded for a PG movie before.
Because you're a lonely man,
well, you know,
age, picking up a movie with Heather O'Rourke. Your name's going on a list. That's why they needed your ID.
Yep, you are in a file, Josh.
My name's already in a file for when I checked the Turner Diaries out of the library.
You rented pay-per-view porn and watched Cartoon Network in the same night.
I want to ask a follow-up to Todd. You brought up the term director's line. Now, when you were on Radiodrome, you also brought up that term. And something I noticed in the comments was a bunch of people going, what is a director's line? I've never heard this term before. Can you elaborate on director's line?
Okay. When you're watching a film, let's use Pulp Fiction as an example. They're sitting in a booth. The first shot of that scene will establish the director's line. And what that is imagine a circle, and there's a line going right through the middle of the circle, okay? Now that is your, where the table and the actor is sitting, is where that line is. Now, you've got Samuel Jackson on the left, and you've got Dr. Travolta on the right. So when you switch in for your tight shots, whether it be a medium shot for, like, say you start with a super wide shot, and you see these guys in a restaurant, and there's all these people around, but they're still the center of the shot. Then you come in a little tighter, and they're still sitting the same way. John Travolta's here, and Samuel Jackson's there. Then you go into the over-the-shoulder shots. You can get close-ups. Then here's the weird part. You stay on that semicircle because you've divided the circle in half, and you keep the camera on one side of that circle. So you go in over the shoulder of Samuel Jackson for John, and over the shoulder of John for Samuel. A lot of movies, they'll cross that line, and suddenly, instead of looking left to right, he's looking the wrong direction. What the hell is he looking at? Because Samuel Jackson's not over there, he's over there, and he's over there. So you kind of start looking at that line of action, and when it's and the line of action is when things are moving through. And let's say it's a car chase, and a car starts on the right side and goes to the left, then all of a sudden the next shot, same theory, the car will be going from the left to the right, jarring the viewer or giving the viewer a questionable confusion about the point of, I guess, direction, the of the actor, the point of intensity or the point of reference. Like if an actor's, say, pointing a gun at another actor and he's pointing a gun across the screen to the left side, if you cut to the wrong angle, suddenly he's pointing it to the right. They're going to be like, it's jarring because even though your mind doesn't pick it up, I guess consciously, it does subconsciously, and it creates a jarring sensation within the viewer. Sometimes people did that as an effect, which was fine, but if you're trying to tell a story visually, you should try to follow the director's line, and that's basically what it is.
Yeah, you can do that if you know what you're doing, because Todd, I know exactly what you're talking about. If you're shooting over one character's right shoulder, then the other character has got to be shot over the left shoulder. It's depending on where they are in the master shot.
Right.
But I mean,
and the thing is, yeah, like you said, you know, people that know how to do it can kind of play with that, because one of the cool things I like is sometimes you'll see a movie where the shot will start over a guy's shoulder, and then as they're talking, it'll be on the belly and it'll move, and suddenly it'll change the director's line right in the middle of a scene, and they've never cut the camera. It'll just change the director's line, position A, B, to a brand new position A, B in the same scene without cutting, and that's pretty cool.
Well, like you've seen in Fight Club, you've heard the story about how David Fincher got in a fight with his editor over the car crash scene?
I have not.
Okay, no. Plot spoiler for those who haven't seen Fight Club. Brad Pitt and Edward Norton are the same person.
Okay, first of all, if you haven't seen Fight Club, stop listening to the show because you will be lost.
Yeah. Well, so what happens is, remember, Brad Pitt is driving the car and Edward Norton is in the passenger seat. They crash the car. And then when the car's flipped over, you have Edward Norton climbing out of the driver's seat. Because they're the same person, Edward Norton was driving all along. The editor kept going and he went over Fincher's head and went to the studio. This needs to be reshot. He's got the actor coming out of the wrong door. Because the editor didn't understand that that was an intentional, quote-unquote, mistake that the audience was supposed to think was a mistake at that point because they didn't know the two characters were the same person.
Yeah, given those two choices, I would side with the guy who has read the script.
But so Todd, something like that where Fincher clearly knew what he was doing while the editor thought this guy just screwed this up.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And I think that that's you make a very valid point that, you know, a lot of time, if not on the set, you also won't understand the aesthetics of what's going on for a scene. But usually an editor, you know, they've got an amazing eye. They know by looking at something, look, man, we've shot this all screwy, especially with the shaky cam stuff going on, like in the movie Gamer, of all places, shots that just don't edit right, and there'll be jump cuts all over the place. And in that moment, you kind of have to feel sorry for the editor, and you have to go, okay, this guy just simply didn't have the coverage he needed, or there would be a jump cut, because any editor with his weight wouldn't allow a jump cut to go out under his name. It's just not something you do, but you know, what are you going to do? A lot of times you're not a set director's trying to get through something. Sometimes they forget a shot or maybe the shot's ruined for whatever reason and they have to go on and do something else. So it just depends. But I do totally understand what's going on with Fight Club because in that instance, he just simply wasn't on the set and didn't understand the aesthetics of the scene.
Right? And see, I've always found I like to have my editor on set. That way he can see how it's shot and he can tell me, I'd really like, you know, a bridging shot here. And then you can go, all right, we've got a couple of minutes. We'll quick do that. When I did It Came From Beyond Midnight, my editor was always on set to say, hey, I'd really love to do a cutaway when you just, because we ad-libbed all that. When you make that joke, I'd really like a cutaway. So I'm there and, you know, you're able to quick get the shot. I've always found it's just easier. So at least the editor I normally worked with, he was editing in his brain during shooting. You know, well, this scene will go together with this and this. Well, that won't cut together. You need to redo that. I don't like what the editor sitting in another room 400 miles away waiting for the footage to come to him 3 weeks later. That, I think, is dangerous.
The director has a specific vision that he's trying to get the editor to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think, like, an editor needs to know his place. Because if the editor has not been on set the whole time and if he does not understand the movie, he just needs to understand one central truth is that you are not the director. The director calls the shots, literally, in this case.
I did editing on a film for a guy once, and I wasn't there for any of his shoot.
I think I know the movie you're talking about.
The one Robert made?
Yes.
It was terrible.
It was fucking awful.
He's standing over my shoulder the whole time. He's like, okay, now due to cut to this scene. I'm like, you don't want to cut to that scene. That'll hurt, you know. You're cutting from this to this. He's wanting me to fade from one scene. The same set. Some guy's trying to break into a house. He's like, now fade to the same thing. I'm like, you can't fade. And your actor's going to go to the other side of the screen in the same shot.
Well, see, even in an instance like that, though, the editor has to know that even if the director is slowly killing himself, he has to let it happen because he is the director.
Yeah, like, I'm like, you want to show passage of time. You don't just fade to the same scene. Cut away to a picture of something else.
Yeah, it was maybe the shortest dissolve I've ever seen in my life.
Well, Todd,
just cut away to a clock and then cut away to another clock and then another clock.
And then all of a sudden you're in an Andy Warhol film.
A Felix clock.
That's right.
And I don't mean this as an insult, and it's not meant as one at all, but you...
That means this is totally going to be an insult.
No, because Todd has made it clear he's not so happy with some of his earlier films. Do you take all the blame for those, or do you blame some of the other people?
Some of it on myself. I blame some of it on my youth, the fact that I was actually just getting together with my friends on a weekend and trying to make a movie. And then we got something cobbled together that kind of had a semblance of something. And then, you know, later on, I was asked to get distribution and I allowed it. So in a way, it's not really a blame thing as much as it is. The blame I have is more about the decision I made, not the films themselves, because look, I made those with friends. I was like, okay, how do I make this look like this? And how do I do lighting? And how do I do this? And how do I make this look like this? And how does Argento get that amazing? I mean, I spent an entire evening just trying to figure out, okay, the aesthetics of Argento's car ride in Suspiria and how I could get that to happen in my movie, because I had a car ride scene, but I didn't want it to be a typical car ride scene like all the other movies. I wanted it to be like Argento's. So I had to sit there and figure out how to make that happen. And it actually surprisingly turned out really well. Things like that. I love it. I loved it. And I wouldn't change that because I was a kid learning how to do something, you know, with a camera, a Super 8 or whatever I could get my hands on. So that part, no, I can't change that. But I change and I get mad at myself over the decision to let them get distribution worldwide, because then suddenly people are looking at these movies that are, you know, made by kids, and they're like judging them against movies made by Scorsese. And I'm sorry, but I don't care who you are, you know. It's kind of an unfair judgment, but then again, it's unfair to assume that a viewer would be any more kind to your movie because you were 13 when you made it, as opposed to a couple of film. It's one of those things. You can't get mad at someone for saying you suck when you suck compared to masters, but you do feel a sting, and you do get upset, and you do feel like some spit in your face. Or crapped in your Cheerios because you've spent a year of your life trying to do something. You wasted all your savings. You were a kid. You were going out of your mind trying to do something good. You know, you went out and mowed 50 lawns in a day to get a camera, and you were just trying to learn. You're naive, and you believe that the world's going to be kind, and it's not, because you know, you're on the same shelf. And the consumer looked at it this way: I walked to Blockbuster, and there were 5 movies. All 5 of those movies are better movies, not 4 movies, some guy's home video.
I know exactly what you mean, Todd. Like, if you take Time Crime, for example, I take all the blame for all the many mistakes in that movie. But on the other hand, I do know that it was the best I could have done at the time. So I can't feel too bad about it.
Well, and also you have to look at, you know, where you're making the movie. How hard was it? You know, 40 extras in the street and people are making a phone call. Yeah, man, they're breaking in this building. Yeah, we're breaking in the building and these are all of our bystanders to watch, and we're documenting it for posterity. The ignorance of the local scene here, the local, I guess I could say, just, you can't make movies in Kansas City, this and that and this and that. Are you making a porno? I was like, dude, let me tell you something. Why would I make a porno? Why would I do that? Why would I make a porno in Kansas City when they're all produced in L.A. for 40 cents?
It's ridiculous. It's like, look at me, sir.
It's one of those things where you get to the point where it's very difficult. Then on top of that, you know, like in Zombie Bloodbath, I had to rip pages out of my script and rewrite things on the fly because we were under a flood, Great Flood of 93 in the Midwest. Our buildings, 7-story buildings, were underwater up to the top of the building. We would have to take boats and get our equipment across highways with boats because they were flooded. I was under contract to have the film done, and it had to be shown theatrically, and I'd already signed all the deals. And so I had to basically, instead of just putting it on hold, I had to finish. And under those conditions, you know, it was a nightmare because I had to rip pages out. I had to rewrite things where it was just on the spur of the moment. You don't have time to really think through and read your script the way you'd like. And so, yeah, the movie came out kind of sloppy because of that. Even though it was my most ambitious and what I considered to be my first real movie, it really sucked for me in respect, because I looked and I was like, God dang, man, I did what I could. But Jesus, man, when I'm tearing 40 pages out of a script, you know, and replacing it with 2 pages of nonsense, that's what I had to do. And unfortunately, people are pissed about it, but that's what I had to do.
Yeah, I mean, hindsight is always 20/20. I mean, when I look back at some of the older stuff I've done, I know that I could do it better now. But at the time, you got to keep in mind that you were pushing yourself, and that's more than a lot of people do.
This guy is going to come up to me afterwards and say, man, you could have done some better stuff. And I looked at him and I said, you know what? You can blow me, because there's absolutely no way under those conditions that we could have done a better job, even though – you know, it's funny because you see a movie like Cop Out come out, or any umpteen Tyler Perry movie, or any of these movies that come out like Skyline, that abysmal nightmare movie where, you know, they've got a budget, they've got a lot going for them, and they don't catch the hell that a guy like you will catch, who had $12.35 and someone stole your camera on the first day and you had to go through hell just getting your movie made. You'll catch more hell than a movie like Skyfall or Cop Out or Madea's Family Reunion Part 28. And those movies are terrible movies. I mean, they're not even well made. Tyler Perry, I've come to realize, may know how to direct a play, but that guy has no business being called a director of cinema. He wouldn't know cinema if it slapped him in the face. Every one of his movies looks like a sitcom or a play. That's just the way it is. Yet no one gives him hell for his lack of technical know-how. But you, buddy, if you go out and make a movie that's $12.50 and you happen to have a flaw here or there, you're a dirty bastard who needs to give up his camera and never touch it again, or I'll kill your grandma.
Yes, and I am all for Tyler Perry getting slapped in the face.
Well, do you guys know the Todd Sheets VHS dilemma? Todd, what was the last price for one of your VHSs on Amazon? $900?
Like $900, yeah.
I need a budget.
I need to find a few and sell them, because I need a budget, I tell you.
No, I'm serious. Todd's movies on VHS go for a ton of money on eBay. They actually go for more than it cost him to make the films.
It's true in some cases, yes. It's really weird. And the highest one I know.
An angel gets its wings whenever that happens.
I think so. A guy wrote to me from Japan a few years back and had me sign one of his movies that he had gotten in Japan for the equivalent of $1,100. And I don't understand why the hell some poor guy. And I apologize. I felt so bad that after I autographed it and I sent it back to Japan for him, I included like four or five copies of my newer stuff that I actually like. Because this guy had one of these old terrible movies I did called Goblin, and he loved the damn thing. He just loved it. But I was like, poor unfortunate guy. I like either he just didn't know what he'd gotten, or he got dropped on his head about 16 times as a child. I couldn't understand why anyone would want it, first of all, and why you'd pay anything like $1,100 U.S. equivalent for anything. So I was like, look, dude, you know, I guess it's all about taste, you know?
What a great autograph that is, though. I'm so very sorry, Todd Sheet.
Well, I know that's the way to do it. I'm so very sorry that you paid such money for this. So for the autograph, that was real nice. But on the letter I included, I told him that. I said, man, I'm sorry you had to pay so much money for this. Here, I've thrown in some other stuff for you to enjoy. And then the funny thing happens. Like, make a movie that awards, and then you'll get a guy right into you saying, man, it was cool and all, but it just wasn't the same as Goblin. And you're like, thank God. But he's like disappointed, and you're going, hold on, man, Moonchild was an extremely well-made movie. I got first prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and Dee Wallace herself gave me my award. I went on to get 8-9 awards for this movie. I'm so proud of it. We had no money, but we did. And then some guy's mad because it wasn't as good as Goblin to him. And I'm going, hold on a minute. Goblin was shot in 2 weekends. It was a piece of dog meat.
You know a lot of celebrities. And you have them in your cell phone, correct?
Yeah.
Do you remember the time you left your cell phone at the diner?
I do. That was hilarious.
And all of a sudden, I get this call from this waitress. Do you know this guy, Todd Sheets? She had just got done calling Sid Haig and asking him, too.
I know. It was great. Little does she know that she called Captain Spaulding. What I wish you had done is called him up and he said, what are you doing with my buddy Todd's phone? I'm about to come up and put my boot off in your ass. That would have been the best way to do it.
What's all that screaming in the background?
Yeah, but Sid's like, Todd, what's going on? Are you okay? Is everything okay? And then they called another person that I know who thought I'd been killed. Someone kidnapped me or taken my phone. It was terrifying.
And it was all just because you were so dumb you left it at a diner.
Well, it had fallen out onto this little side thing.
I hope that someday Lloyd Kaufman will get a call from a waitress saying, do you know Charlie McMullen?
That's hilarious.
I have Lloyd in my phone, too, actually. I just have him listed as Troma, though, but it's his direct line. That's weird.
I guess the way it is for all of us, because we call him Uncle Lloyd.
Lloyd's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have a photo ID for him in your phone? I do. It's just a picture of a chainsaw that I took at Sears.
That's funny. I don't do that kind of thing because I'm so angry, okay? The old flip phones that look like Star Trek communicators, and I don't like anything else. So
I still have one of those. Line,
I can't play like I'm James T. Kirk and flip it open in the middle of like Sears and go, like using the smartphones. So my phone finally crapped. I went to get a new one, and they said, well, we don't have that model. We don't have flip phones anymore. We got Androids and this and that. And I'm like, yeah, I can look up the weather in Afghanistan, but I sure can't figure out what the hell's going on with making a phone call because it hangs up on every single person you call. So I haven't even gotten as far as, like, put pictures with phone numbers because usually when someone's calling in, I'm too busy trying to figure out how to answer the damn thing before it stops ringing. And you have to, like, slide to the left, slide down, hit this number in, and hope to God you can get there in enough time that they don't hang up.
Well, so Todd, am I able to chastise you on the air then for asking why in the hell the ringtone that I listen to when I call you is Enya?
It's 5 or 6 different ringtones. I don't even know how they got there.
Because all of a sudden I called you before this show, and Enya starts, and I'm like, what the hell?
It should put you in a mellow mood then, right?
It's because it wants to sail away.
That's it. Time, whatever that song was that was on there last time I checked, I was going back. But then all of a sudden, the next time you call, it'll be Iron Maiden. There's no rhyme or reason because I was trying to put an Iron Maiden song, and I was trying to move these songs around and put them in a queue. And the next thing I know, they're all over my ring back thing. I have no idea.
Well, why do you even have Enya on your phone?
I like Enya. He is awesome. Apparently, a lot of people like Enya because Titanic ripped off Enya completely. The entire soundtrack was like, let's not go and pay Enya to do it. Let's rip it off and have someone else do it, but it'll sound just like Enya.
Yeah, it's like an Enya tribute band.
It is. The Titanic soundtrack is like an Enya tribute. I was like, what is going on here? Why didn't they just go get her? She's the one.
Because well, have you guys
she's pretty creative.
Have you guys ever heard Todd's Jedi Superstar Rock Band?
No.
That does sound awesome.
Yeah, there's not one part of the sentence that I don't enjoy.
there's something to be said about Jedi Superstar. It's kind of like the musical version of going to a drive-in movie theater between the 60s and the 90s when it was still awesome. Like the beginning of the 90s, all drive-ins were being killed off and the movie stunk anyway. But like 60s, 70s, 80s, it's kind of like the musical version of that is when you listen to Jedi because it's kind of it's a straight rock and roll band, but we throw everything in the kitchen sink and we do whatever we want. We sing songs about sci-fi and about TV shows we love, like Johnny Sacco and Ultraman. And we sing songs about, like, I'd rather kiss a Wookiee. Some of the songs will raise your eyebrows. We have the odes to Russ Meyer. More than a handful is the Russ Meyer special song that we have. There's lots of that.
So
it's kind of a fun thing. That's right. All of the exploitation cinema that I grew up with, science fiction movies and TV shows, and, of course, let's not forget Benny Hill. He inspired us all.
Oh, well, hey, let's also not forget Russ Meyer was also always keeping abreast of the situation.
He was, and he was good at it. Watch a Russ Meyer movie, it's almost like you almost feel guilty because it's like watching a Looney Tunes cartoon with lots of TNA.
I think a Russ Meyer film is the definition of exploitation film.
It is great. Yeah, it's great.
They are. But because Russ Meyer owned the rights to all of his movies for so long, the only way to get them on video is to pay like $80 a piece.
Yeah, to Russ Meyer directly.
Well, unfortunately, that's because of his wife, I believe, is in charge of a lot of that now, of his estate. And she basically kind of make sure that the stuff, even though she thinks she's doing it, you know, a solid, I think the stuff could sell a lot more. If you drop that price by 50%, you sell them for $40 or $35, if you sell it for $20 and you put it out on Blu-ray and you go let someone go back and get the original film elements, which she has, it would do a wonder. Like the DVDs, none of that is from a film master. That's all from a 1-inch master. And they're selling those DVDs for like $34.99. I guess the cheapest I've seen them was at Amigo Music in Los Angeles for $29.99. She lives right down the street, and they just, you know, hook up with her. But those movies need to be seen everywhere. I remember back in the day, Best Buy had them, and I could get them there for $19.99. But yeah, she's really not a very good business person when it comes to cinema. And I think these movies are untapped, and they need to do like a set of all the Russ Meyer stuff on Blu-ray and let people go back and get the original film masters, the negatives, and just go through there and remaster them and make them beautiful. And she would get rich. It's a lot more people would be able to afford it than now because you buy two movies and you spent $80 and you're like, wow, man, I can't buy anymore. We're done. So that's kind of a very sad thing, because I believe Russ Meyer was kind of a genius, really.
I just recently sold my Russ Meyer Laserdisc set. There was almost a feeding frenzy over it when I posted it on Facebook. This is for sale. I had at least 10 different people going, how much you want for it, within an hour.
Nice.
And I think I sold that thing for like $250 for the Russ Meyer Laserdisc set. And it was just, people were just, I want those. And I believe the Laserdiscs are from Film Elements, because they were much better quality than the DVDs, Todd. So I think the Laserdiscs are probably the closest you're going to get.
Well, the Laserdiscs also came from a 1-inch master, but they're 1-inch, or maybe they're 1.5. The Beta MSP masters are what they used for the Laserdiscs, which were closer than what they used for the DVDs. They were better, because Beta MSP is pretty damn sweet, especially it was the best format you could have there for a long time. And the fact is, the lines of resolution on Laserdisc was much higher than DVD. People didn't even realize this, but you know, you'd have 700 whatever lines of resolution on a Laserdisc, and a DVD would only do Super VHS quality lines, which were, you know, what, 420 lines. So you almost got double that on a Laserdisc. But unfortunately, the Laserdisc went the way of the dinosaur. I still have a ton of them myself. I love them. But I don't watch them very often, because I'm afraid one day the Laserdisc player quit working, I'll never be able to find a decent one like I've got. I've got a really good one. And like, I got Never on Tuesday, one of my all-time favorite movies. It's been announced on DVD about 9 times, never been released. It's a fantastic movie, just fantastic. And I got it on Laserdisc for $7. Because I was like, you know, it's going to be the best quality I'm going to be able to get until they put out a DVD.
Well, all right, then let me ask Charlie and Alex something. If someone was to put out a Todd Sheets DVD set, or since Todd's such a Blu-ray whore, or a Blu-ray set, if they were going to put out the Todd Sheets movies, would you buy them?
Yeah.
I would buy them, yeah.
Even if Todd doesn't like most of them, you think you would?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not whether or not I like something is completely apart from, you know, what the director thinks. I mean, because, you know, like, if I ever met Martin Scorsese, I would say, dude, my favorite movie of yours is The King of Comedy. And I don't know how he would feel about that, but doesn't change the way I feel about it.
Exactly. Exactly. I got to tell you, though, you know, luckily for me, aside from those horrible packs that came out through Brain Damage Films, they licensed all that old stuff through Dave and J.R. Bookwalter. I didn't have the rights to it. But if it's up to me, anything that comes out on DVD, like the Zombie Bloodbath trilogy is out, and coming soon are two more box sets of movies that I've done, because I've been remastering them. It's in my time that I have. That's why it's taken 2 years. I've been remastering these movies, and the original elements were thrown away by Inglewood Entertainment, who licensed them. And of all things, they lost the masters because of the gray holes. They didn't lose them at all. They recorded them, because I know the guy that did it. But I had to go back to my original master tapes and match these soundtracks frame by frame, which is meticulously nightmarish. So I've been doing that, and those are going to be coming out on DVD here, hopefully within the next 6 months. Those two box sets will see light of day. There's going to be a total of 8 more Todd Sheets monstrosities, at least upon the world, but at least these I'm proud of for whatever various reasons. They're not perfect, for God's sakes. We made them on pennies, but they're still much better as far as the technical side of things. I knew more what I was doing. I learned from mistakes. And like the Zombie Bloodbath trilogy, a lot of people write to me and say, hey, it's really weird. We can really see what goes on between number one, number two, and number three. It's like a huge leap in filmmaking on each one. And it's because I made them a couple years apart and I did other movies between it. And it's a learning experience. And I really appreciate that. So, yeah, I make sure anything that I put out there now, I prove it, because I'm not gonna, like I said, except for the Brain Damage stuff, because I don't like any of that stuff.
Well,
that
yeah, old I mean, stuff. If Mike Judge can do it, I mean, because Mike Judge's like personal selection of Beavis and Butthead cartoons came out on DVD like a good 15 years after the show had gone off the air. But yep. That's what it took to release the ones that he really liked.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. The demand was there. That's kind of what's happening to me. There's been a resurgence of sorts with my films, and people are really wanting to see more of it, getting ready to do this new movie, and everyone's like, you know, wanting stuff out there. And so, you know, distributors are hearing the word, and luckily I got my foot in the door back in 89 before, you know, all this mess of let's face it, I've got buddies who are in the distribution who tell me, you know, they get 600 DVDs a week or more, sometimes 1,000. And those are the ones that they even, you know, that even make it there. And they, you know, we can't watch them. And the ones we do watch, we get so mad at, we just take them out, throw them on a pile. And it's sad because somewhere in there is the next Raimi, but there's just too much going on. There's too many people and you can't get your foot in the door. So every once in a while, a magical thing will happen and you might win a festival or something and people will go, hey, that won at this festival. Let's watch this movie at least. And that's why nowadays almost every DVD for an indie horror film has some kind of a little leaf thing on it saying winner or first choice at this film festival. Of course, everyone and their mom at the film festival, the, you know, blow my ass film festival over here in North Carolina. So everyone's got one of those, but that's what it takes to get someone to open an eyeball and look. Sometimes a guy, true story, made his own film festival just because someone would look at his movie, made sure that his movie won his own film festival, and then suddenly someone looked at it. So unfortunately, that's the truth. And luckily, I got in before all that nonsense, so I have
that
reputation.
It's all about presentation. I mean, Ich bin ein Berliner means I'm a donut.
That's right. That's right. You could be the only judge of your own movie, but if it's in front of your box, they'll at least look at it. And now that I said that, everybody with a camera will not only rush to Best Buy and get another camera, but they will also have their own film festival. So good, great job. Wonderful.
Well, Todd, then let me ask you, outside of all that, and I better see a Bimbo's BC DVD release, by the way.
But it's not going to happen. Not going to happen.
Don't you own some crappy radio station that has these really awful shows that have ridiculous self-important guests on?
What I've got is I've got a radio station that used to be pretty cool, and everyone loved it. Then I hired this guy, Josh Hadley, who made enemies apparently worldwide, caused us to get hacked every third week, and decided he would jump on every single show that we have on the network so he could either make a guest spot or he could take over like you have these poor guys.
Well, Josh, they were all intimidated. I'm comfortable with you because I'm not scared of you.
Yeah, but he's essentially saying you're the herpes of employees.
I know. It's just not even right. I don't even understand it, you know. If it wasn't for the fact that I had an Iron Maiden shirt on in the picture, I may have to stomp a mud hole.
Run through the hills.
It's like Beaker singing an Iron Maiden song, and it really kind of frightened me. Or maybe Elmo.
Beep, 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 beep. So well, and then you have your own show on this crappy radio station, don't you?
I do. It's called Nightwatch, and yes. you can check it out by going to nightwatchradio.com or jackalradio.com. But nightwatchradio.com has up-to-date archives and a whole bunch of goofy stuff over there to look at. And it's a weekly show that is also syndicated. It started out in syndication, actually, and the reason I made it part of this network was because the original producer at a radio station here quit the business, and so someone had to produce my show, and I had to start figuring out how to do it myself. So I started learning the software and everything, and I thought, well, if I'm paying all the money for this, I might as well help some of my friends out and get their shows on. And then a network was born, and then before you know it, because of the night, watch Jackalope Lewis. So they kind of go together in a symbiotic relationship I happen to enjoy. And which kind of has a life of its own, though, away from the station. It's a 422 stations worldwide, including the BBC. Number one overnights in Australia, Sydney and Melbourne on AM and FM radio there. And it's a lot of fun. It takes a lot of time and effort, but it's a family, man. The group of us do Night Watch as a family. Just like the extension of that is Jackalope is a family, because if Nightwatch created Jackalope, then I wanted it to be ran the same way I did the show, which was, you know, honorably, with integrity. And even though I'm one man who really needs like a staff of 40, it's one of them things where, honestly, I try to do everything I can to keep that family atmosphere. People can trust each other here, and we grow. And last time I checked, man, this little station that started out with, you know, a few thousand listeners, sitting about 4 million a week. So that's pretty unbelievable.
And it's inspired me personally to speak properly from now on.
I haven't done that yet, so I don't know why you're worried. As a matter of fact, this is a true story. I had a guest on the show who was a pretty well-known actor, and he told me he was going to Japan, so I instantly said, you dirty bastard. I called this actor a dirty bastard right on 9/11. Why don't you put me in your suitcase, you jerk? So that tells you I haven't learned a thing about etiquette. But and then we just had Alan Kaiser in the studio, the Bradster from Night of the Creeps. He was here with us last night, and I tell you what, by the time he left, he had tears, either of fear or of joy. I couldn't tell, but it was quite the show. I don't know. I think he was kind of frightened for his life after he was here because of the crazy stuff we do. Nothing is sacred on Night Watch or on any show, and I do not impose any kind of censorship. You guys, it's your show. You do what you want. It's your hour. It's your 2 hours, whatever you have. And it's, you know, Geek Juice is a part of the family. We love having a show. I've loved it since the first day. And it's really good that we can continue on like this because, you know, your listener base is growing. You got a lot of friends out there who care about the show. And every week it gets bigger and better and bigger and better. And if you could just keep the riffraff off like Josh Hadley, then maybe you can keep on growing.
Hey, Pete and I keep the energy up at this station, Todd. But Pete and I keep the crazies to our shows, so then the rest of you are safe.
That's probably true in some bizarre way, Josh.
You're like the bouncers of mental illness.
Kind of. I mean, hey, you guys never heard that Pete show where the angry midget called on and threatened Pete, Todd, and I.
Yeah, that was fun.
Was pissed.
That was one of my favorite radio moments, actually, of all time.
Yeah, that was one of the live episodes, and that little chick was pissed.
she was ready to stomp a mud hole, I'll tell you.
That little chick, huh?
Yeah. All 4 foot of her fury was coming our way.
Yeah, you guys should check that one out in the archives. Pete, Todd, and I were just like, what in the hell is going on?
I got to figure out which show that is, because it's and I got to label it Midget Revenge. So I'll be. I got to label
it. So, Bank, they want you stand up. Oh, I'm sorry.
So, all right. Since I've hijacked their show, you guys want to sig out?
Yeah, Charlie.
Will you do that? Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been a great show. I have learned a lot. I hope you have learned some. Join us next week, Geek Juice Radio. Check out our website, www.geekjuice.com. Okay, I've promised myself I'm going to stop saying the W's, because if you don't know that, then you don't own a computer, and I'm just wasting my breath anyway. GeekJuiceMedia.com. We have also got Live Nude Geeks on Monday nights. We have got someone from this website will most often guest on one of Josh Hadley's shows, Lost in the Static, Radio Drone, or What the F, since this is Geek Juice Radio. And look for us individually on Facebook. And thank you very sincerely for listening, everybody. Stay tuned for the projection booth with Mike White. If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be swimming like California. Surfing USA. You catch a surfing out there. Sure, a county life. Stir a goose and dredging. Stir a cabla beach. Roll over Manhattan. A WME wave. Everybody's got surfing. Surfing USA. We'll be planning the route. Take real soon. Waxing down our surfboard. Can't wait for June. We'll be gone for the summer. We're so far to stay. Still the teacher, we're surfing. Surfing USA.